So people often assume that the folks who designed our lectionary, the schedule of which Bible passages we hear each week, that they designed it so that the various readings connect in some way. But for most of the year, not Advent or Lent, but for most of the year, certainly this time of year, that is actually not the case. Instead, each set of readings, the Old Testament readings, the epistle readings, and the gospel readings, each follow their own sequence. So it's actually like reading three books at once. Some of you probably do this. Some of you think this is unimaginable. Reading three books at once, picking up one book one night, reading a little bit, and then putting it down and picking up the next book and reading a little bit of that one. That means that preachers at this time of year are confronted with excellent stories that we really want to make fit together. But if we did that, we would be here for hours. And so we have to choose. This morning, it was really hard to choose, which is why I feel like I have to defend myself. But all summer, we have been reading the family stories in the book of Genesis, beginning with the call to Abram and Sarai, and then moving down through the generations of their descendants. And this is the story that captivated me this week. So earlier this summer, we heard Abraham and Sarah become Abraham and Sarah, following God's call, receiving God's promise. We heard the joyful story of the birth of their son Isaac, the fulfillment of that promise, and the surprise and delight of his very elderly parents. I believe the line is near to death. We also heard the hard stories of Sarah and Abraham's cruel mistreatment of Hagar, and of Hagar and Abraham's son Ishmael. And we heard of the time that Abraham almost killed Isaac in obedience to God. We heard how Rebekah came to marry Isaac, and how they eventually had two sons, twins, born in struggle with one another, and how Rebekah favored the younger, Jacob, but Isaac favored the older, Esau. And we heard how that sad story played out with deceit and betrayal and estrangement. We followed Jacob into exile. We met his first two wives, Rachel, whom he loved, and Leah, who he was tricked into marrying. And we followed Jacob home to reconcile with his brother, stopping on the way to wrestle a blessing from God and to receive a new name, Israel. And then, jumping ahead quite a few years, we arrive at this morning's reading, and we hear the story of Jacob's sons, the inheritors of the promise and of generations of family dysfunction. Like his parents and his grandparents before him, Jacob had a favorite and a favored son. Like their father and grandfather before them, Jacob's boys knew that love was a commodity in too short supply for everyone to have. Joseph lords his beloved status over his brothers. Perhaps because he's oblivious? Maybe he's just a jerk? Or maybe to hide the pain of not having the love of his brothers, of being on the outside of their fraternity. We all know that family dysfunction plays out in myriad of ways. And then, one terrible, terrible day, Jacob's boys let their anger and their pain get the best of them, and they do something truly awful. They sell Joseph into slavery and tell their father he has been killed by wild beasts. We know the rest of the story, of course, and if you're fuzzy, we'll hear it next week. Joseph ends up in Egypt, where on the strength of his ability to interpret dreams, he becomes a trusted advisor to Pharaoh and saves Egypt from the famine that ravages the surrounding lands. He is reconciled to his brothers and restored to his father, saving Israel from the famine by bringing them into Egypt. We know the rest of that story too, but I'll stop here. For this is really where the story of Abraham's family ends and the story of the nation of Israel begins, and today I'm interested in family stories. We all have them, after all, family stories. The details, I suspect, would be quite different from those of Abraham and his descendants. But many of us could tell some similar stories of our own families. The first ancestor. Perhaps that's the first to come to Canada. Or perhaps the first to start the business. Or the first to move to the big city. And then the stories of that ancestor's children. Who married who in what scandalous fashion? Who had children too soon? Or surprisingly late? Which marriages were happy and which were not? Which brothers and sisters stuck together and which fell out with arguments over inheritance or lifestyle or priorities? Who made good? Whose potential was sadly wasted? Who set the course for generations to come? But how many of us, I wonder, as we told these stories, would name God's action in our family stories? How many of us assume that God's directing hand is actually in charge? That is generally how we read the stories of Abraham and his family. Because they're in the Bible, we assume that things happen the way they did because that's what God wanted, because that's what God made happen. And the stories themselves can sometimes suggest that it is true. Sometimes, after all, God gives very direct instructions or provides very obvious signs. Not all the time, but certainly more often than in my own personal experience. And, of course, much is made of God's faithfulness to the promise made to Abraham that he would become the father of a nation. And since that hard-to-believe promise came to pass, it is easy to see all the things in between as being God's work too. And sometimes, when it's a happy story, that feels good and right. When the marriage works out, when the baby is born, when the brothers make up. But sometimes terrible things happened in this story. Lies and trickery, forced marriages, violent jealousy, abandonment, enslavement. This is a family that would be at home in a binge-worthy Netflix drama series. Is God really writing this story? And although our lives are, by and large, a little less epic, they are not less complicated, bringing both joys and sorrows, ease and anxiety, love and hatefulness. What is God's involvement in our lives? And where does our own free will come into play? One of the troubles with stories is that we can only tell one story at a time. When we tell the story of what happened, of how we got here, we don't tell the stories of what might have happened, how else we might have got here or somewhere else. If Rebecca had declined to travel to a strange land and marry an unknown man, if Isaac had ended up marrying a different cousin instead, Would that have been the end of God's promise to Abraham? Or would the story simply have been different? If Rebecca and Isaac had found a way to parent their two very different sons, Esau and Jacob, so that they saw themselves as a team instead of as opponents, and were never estranged, would that have been the end of God's work in the descendants of Abraham and Sarah? Or would the story simply have been different? If Jacob had overcome his parents' bad example and been able to create a family where love was shared in abundance, so that his sons would never turn on one another, would Jacob's family, would God's chosen people, have been lost to famine? Or would the story simply have been different? All of our lives are full of such turning points, moments on which our futures hinge. Sometimes those moments are our choices, opportunities taken or passed by, mistakes made or avoided, this option or that one. Sometimes these moments are other people's choices, and we have no say in the matter. And sometimes these moments are not choices at all, but simply events, an illness, an accident, a windfall that changes the course of our story in one way or another. And when we look back on the story, especially from some distance, it is easy to see the whole thing as inevitable, mistaking cause and effect for destiny, or the controlling hand of God. We lack the capacity to see the web of possibilities not pursued, the imagination to decenter our own experience of our lives. But God is bigger than that. God is bigger than any particular decision, any particular tragedy, any particular gift, any particular life. Which means that God works in all of them. But God doesn't require any of them. So let's get back to the question I asked earlier. What is God's involvement in our lives? If God is bigger than any particular life, does God even care about our choices? Does God have a will for our lives at all? Yes, and yes. At creation, God made the trees and the grasses and the fish and the birds and the beasts and the humans to be fruitful and multiply. God's promise to Abraham was that he would be fruitful, the father of a great and faithful nation. Biological fruitfulness is an ancient way to talk about abundance, security, fullness of life for communities and for individuals. And of course, biological fruitfulness is often part of such a life, but there are other ways to be fruitful as well. God's will for our life is that we be fruitful, that we have fullness of life, living fully into the image of God in which we were created, creative and generous and compassionate and faithful. And so we seek to discern which choices lead us to greater fruitfulness. We seek to discern how to find fruitfulness even in the context of tragedy. We seek to discern how to respond to the fruitfulness we already know. We ask God to help us see a good way forward. Sometimes, maybe, the very best way, but rarely the only way. And so we step out, and we ask God to make us faithful, a trait that is a little shaky, quite frankly, in Abraham's family. But we ask God to make us faithful so that we can trust that God's promise will hold firm no matter what happens. That we will not be lost, no matter how dark a road we turn down, no matter how deep a pit we are cast into. We ask God to make us faithful so that we can trust that God will be with us, working with us to bring life out of death and hope out of despair, just as God worked with Hagar and Ishmael when they were abandoned in the wilderness. Or with Isaac, when he came down the mountain after his father nearly killed him. Or with Jacob, after he betrayed his father and his brother. Or with Joseph, after he was sold into slavery. God is constantly working in our lives, grounding us, sustaining us, nurturing us, inspiring us. But they are our lives, freely given to us by God, to tell the story that we will uncover. What story are you going to tell with your one beautiful God-given life?